So it boosted us from about a 15-yard footing pour to an 18-yard footing pour. Okay, that's money. That's $375. But against the scope of the house, what's $375 worth to significantly reduce any likelihood of a structural problem? It makes sense to me.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are in the shop. If you're not watching the video, we're in the back of the shop. This is going to be our new setting. It's actually not new now. This is our third episode of this, this new podcast. So if you want to see the setting, get a feel for it, it's on our second channel, EC2. And is it Wednesday?
Yeah.
Okay, it's Wednesday, and we just finished 100% the footing forming for the foundation at the spec house, and we're finished with plenty of time to spare. The concrete doesn't get there till tomorrow, and so we are here just to sort of recap and kind of talk through, and I've got some questions that I asked at the time while we were doing that job, while I was kind of running the cameras, that I thought that might not have made it to the final video, so I wanted to give my dad a chance to kind of go through some of those in more depth. And then tomorrow will be the concrete. It's likely that you guys have all seen that already, so hopefully there's no disasters. All right, now the first question, we had a discussion already about the excavation and the digging and how that might have gone differently with different foundation types or even different equipment. My first question, and I know you answered it, but I still kind of wonder, would it have been possible or would there have been a big downside to just digging just the 24-inch wide footings and not having to form on either side of them? Would that have been less work or more work? Or why is that not? Why was that not the best option for this situation?
The strip footings or all the way around, you mean?
Just all the way around. Like, why dig everything out? Why not just dig down deep right where the footing goes, you know, dirt form,
okay,
dirt bank form?
So the first thing would be there's a code about how much space there has to be from the bottom of the floor joist to your grade inside. Uh-huh. So as soon as you start digging down inside of there and then lay a floor joist on top, you're going to be in violation of that code. I want to say it's 18 inches, but it might be 24. So you've got to maintain that. I mean, as soon as you start going down, you've got to be relieving that distance. You could have dug in 8 inches and then come straight up. But we were counting on getting additional strength out of those stem walls by it. The vertical distance of the stem wall grows the strength of the stem wall acting as a beam, mm-hmm, rapidly. So in order to do that, we had to go down with the footing as we're getting taller with the stem wall so that the house is not a ridiculous distance out of the ground. Mm-hmm. So that would be item one. The other thing would be that it gets really tricky working down inside a trench, tying and finishing off the top of a footing flat enough to accept block, mm-hmm, because you can't get down there, you can't tie. By the time you're getting down in there and tie, you're knocking dirt off the top and it's filling up the bottom that then you have to fish out. And so it's just kind of it's a buildability question, which is something an engineer has to grapple with. An engineer can design something that works structurally where he has the right margin of safety and everything is strong, but it's not buildable. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those things where buildability snapped into focus, and especially those strip footings down the middle, we're going to frame a wall and sit on those. So the top of those has to be pretty darn smooth and very flat, because I don't want to have to cut. It would be nice if I didn't have to cut each stud radically different in order, wow, to get a flat enough wall top that the joists will bear on there.
Right.
So those are some of the reasons.
Yeah. And I guess thinking about the way this crawl space would work, there wouldn't be much of a crawl space if all that dirt was still there. That's probably, yeah, what that 18-inch requirement is. Am I thinking of that right? That's basically the minimum height that crawl space could be.
Yeah,
18 inches or whatever it is.
I hope I'm saying that right. I think it is 18 inches of clearance, and it's not just for access. It's so that the spores of the fungus that are in the soil that will attach themselves to wood, mm-hmm, and initiate rot in the wood, so that there's some distance there, so that moisture, mm-hmm, in the soil separated by a vapor barrier still doesn't you know, it's to create distance between the wood that can deteriorate and the soil that has all of the agents that can deteriorate it.
Yeah.
And provide room so you can crawl around under there both during construction and in the future and do your work.
Yeah, great. All right, now let's talk about the tolerance on the footing. When you were laying that out and I was holding the tape measure, I was just having a hard time understanding why quarter inch, you know, accuracy on the edges of those footings that are 4 feet underground could possibly matter. My mindset was sort of, I mean, if they're 3 inches too big on each side, what's the big deal? Mm-hmm. So talk through that. What's the rationale for getting those so accurate? And forgive me, audience, maybe we covered this really well in the video. It's kind of hard to remember. And actually, we haven't even edited those videos all together yet, so you're getting a double dose. But I think it's important because those footings are deep underground, mm-hmm. and you were, in some cases, you were really pushing it down to 1/8 of an inch accuracy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you were really paying attention how close that was, and that just seems a long ways away from a door being plumb or, mm-hmm. you know, a window being square. So talk through that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good question. So part of that was, you remember how much attention we paid to getting the batter boards where they need to be so that we knew where the building was going to be sitting and we knew it was square. And then transferring those marks from the batter boards and the strings down to the footings, if we went back to the site now, we would see that most of the batter boards have been torn down. Mm-hmm. They've been removed. They're gone. So the care that we took in establishing the building location of the batter boards now is going to have to be, that work will have to be done again unless we know for sure that the forms themselves are nearly as accurate as the batter boards were. And so it was just a way of kind of transferring and preserving the work we did to get the batter boards and the building line locations accurate off the wall to get close enough with the forms that when we started establishing the templates for the rebar, we wouldn't have the rude awakening of finding we were 1.5 inches out of center with a template, which put the edge of the rebar in the side of the block, and then the block wouldn't fit. And so it was just an exercise in diligence to make sure that when they start laying the block, all the blocks just slip right down over the rebar, lots of room for the grout to fill all the way around between the vert and the cell.
Yeah.
And then when it comes time to snap those lines again, we know, okay, these forms are very close.
Yeah.
So we can just jump right on it, pull off the form, get some lines, do a casual double check, and not have to go through the whole layout drill again.
Yeah, very cool. Now, we've talked about this choice of a foundation being a crawl space as opposed to the other ones. And I know there were at least one I can think of, very, very slight modification that you made, you know, on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that, but maybe more importantly, any other thoughts? You know, we're committed to this. Well, we committed to this system a long time ago, but do you have any concerns or thoughts now that this system is sort of laying on the ground about to accept mud? Would you do it differently in any way if you were, you know, could wind the clock back? Or is this still the best system for this house?
I'm comfortable with this system. I'm comfortable with the design that Dave Thomas has proposed to deal with differential settlement, which is a big thing here. I mean, the back part of that lot's hard. The front part of that lot is not as hard. The foundation is strong enough to deal with that. The deviation from the plans that you mentioned, those interior strip footings were drawn at 18 inches wide with a little spread footing popped out to 2 foot 2 inches wide in one location in each of the spread footings. And so instead of forming that at 18 inches and cutting them apart and creating another little interior footing, I just formed the whole thing, both strip footings, 24 inches wide. Mm-hmm. That is going to commit us to an extra 0.5 yard of mud, but we didn't have to cut into those forms and pop it out, and seemed a good cost-benefit trade-off to me. And then out in the front, those four piers that are located under the posts that are holding up the porch,
mm-hmm.
they're right out on the very front edge of that lot where the fill is the deepest. And they were heavily compacted. But one of the worst problems that I could envision over time with that house would be if differential settlement started moving those piers down, or they started to rotate, or those columns in that house began to sort of get a buckling moment or a tipping moment. I mean, that would really be a bad thing. So I tied those front, I enlarged the front piers to about 3 feet square from 2 feet square and tied them straight back into the house foundation so that that whole front porch is acting as together with the house foundation itself. Cleared that with Dave Thomas. He didn't see any problem with making that whole system that stiff. And so that probably cost us another probably 2.5 yards of concrete. So now we're 3 yards of extra concrete, but for me at least a good deal of additional peace of mind that we've done everything we can and the foundation design is really good.
Yeah, it's kind of neat walking around the site because every piece of that footing is connected to every other piece. It's uniform. Yeah. You could follow one piece of rebar all the way around that whole thing and come right back where you started. And it's very coherent and it feels like that's the only way to go. You know, it kind of seems like if those piers were on their own little slab that wouldn't make sense. So it's very logical to have it all tied together like that, certainly.
Yeah, it feels good. And so it boosted us from about a 15-yard footing pour to an 18-yard footing pour. Okay, that's money. That's $375. But against the scope of the house, what's $375 worth to significantly reduce any likelihood of a structural problem? It makes sense to me.
All right, so do you think it's possible for a person of ordinary intelligence and average skill who wants to build their own house to lay out, let's say, this exact thing on their own if they had plenty of time? Or is this one of those things that you would say, just bring in a pro, don't bother? Or is it just depend too much on the individual?
Well, it depends completely on the individual. But having said that, it is not rocket science. And an ordinary person, average intelligence, physically fit, you could certainly do it if you have the tools and if you get some knowledge from some folks. I know of a fellow here in Roseburg who has taken it upon himself to build his whole house almost unaided from scratch. And he's doing it, but he's had a few real near misses, forms blowing out, you know, not understanding how hard concrete pushes. And so far, he's going to be able to survive that. Hopefully, his finished product won't have anything that can't be glossed over, won't have any kind of a functional mistake in there that can't be hidden. I mean, that's something you got to be able to do. Mm-hmm. So, you can do it. But, you know, Clint Eastwood said it right, a man's got to know his limitations, and I wouldn't say everybody can do it.
Yeah, and probably you'd really have to emphasize that you have plenty of time.
Because
if you had plenty of time to check it 15 different directions and just not be in a hurry and have confidence before the mud went in, sure.
And bring in other people to troubleshoot it and get their opinion and implement their suggestions. So that's a concept in construction. And some people, a lot of people are going to disagree with this, but I still think it's true, that anybody can make anything perfect if they have enough time and enough material.
You do think that's true?
I think it's absolutely true. Anybody, anybody can make virtually anything virtually perfect given enough time and enough material.
Yeah.
If you can do it over and over, if you can go as slow as you want, if you can get all the information and the guidance that you want and go incrementally and then throw it away a dozen times, you're going to learn how to do it through the process of failing, just like the rest of us learn. And so the same thing would be true with this, but you would have to have time and you would have to get the opinion of the guys that are going to be pouring the concrete if you can, and don't try to pour it. Don't try to pour it. The concrete will not forgive you.
Yeah. Something like this, I imagine, if you're by yourself, could be like a whack-a-mole situation where you get one corner just right and you think you're done and you go double-check something else and it popped out, you know, half an inch over here or the elevation. Now, you mentioned casually there, make sure you have the right tools before you start. And the project I did in Arizona, when I look back at what I would have done differently, I didn't maybe think about that quite right, but having the right tools from day one can just be critical. On a job like this, it would probably be the laser would be the tool, meaning that not everybody has.
Right.
Meaning if you're going to do this, go out and spend
$600
on a laser on the first day, and and you will get that money back and save it tenfold. For me, on my project, that would have been a little tractor or a skid steer or something like that.
Right.
And I just wasn't thinking that way, but I would assert you wouldn't want to even try this without an honest to goodness like builder's laser cutting edge.
That's absolutely right. And the other thing would be a good wire reel for tying. You know, maybe one of those twist tie things to cut some of the frustration out of the tying. Because one of the things with tying rebar, if you can't tie it, you start minimizing it. And you start avoiding places that it really should have it because you subconsciously just don't want to do it. And that's going to build in problems at inspection time. That's one thing that today we passed the inspection the first time. The inspector got out of her truck. She looked it over. She was instantly comfortable because of the appearance. She was instantly aware that we hadn't skimped on rebar. Anyway, so if you can do that, and anybody can do that, if they're willing to do that, it's going to facilitate getting the approval to do it.
Yeah. You know, talking about a laser, I still even wouldn't feel comfortable picking one of those up and using it. But I imagine it's like any tool where once you've just handled it a few times, it kind of clicks, and you almost, if a listener, for example, is thinking, well, if I bought one, I wouldn't know how to use it. It's maybe the situation where you're not going to learn how to use it unless you buy one and get it set up and fiddle around with it. So
just
take some good advice. And if you're going to do this, buy a laser, I would assume. All right. Yeah. Okay, now next topic. This is really the end of our first little phase or milestone. There's going to be too many to count of us both being here with the cameras rolling. Now, you've done a good amount of filming, not just on this project, but in the shop by yourself, and you've gotten really good at it. What is it like? Talk about that a little bit. You know, not just having the camera there when you're setting it up and pointing it, but also when somebody else, me, is there pointing it and such, and maybe compare that to what it'd be like doing a job without, you know, any cameras on site at all.
Okay, so the camera drives productivity through the floor. The camera kills productivity for a couple of reasons. When you're filming it yourself, you're repositioning the camera and you work for a while, and then you reposition the camera and you work for a while, but the problem is you're never thinking solely of the work. And so you never get into that production cycle that you can get into when the camera's not there. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about the mistakes you're making, or if there was a better angle, or if the light's right, or any number of things. Or even when you're filming it and taking care of all that, I can't stop thinking about the fact that a camera's running. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not entirely engaged with the work itself. I'm partially engaged with the filming, and it just slows the work up. I think it will triple the time it takes to build this house.
Yeah.
And that makes me nervous, you know, for just because the rains are coming. You know, by Thanksgiving it's going to be really wet around here. Having said that, it also makes the work way more interesting. You get tired of banging boards together after a while, and you get tired of forming concrete, and you get tired of these things. And now you interject the aspect of filming it. It's so much more interesting, but it definitely slows up. It reduces productivity.
Yeah, it really does. I'm impressed on YouTube. There's just so many good video and content creators right now. If we're not in the golden age right now, then I can't wait till the golden age starts, because it's pretty good right now.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically of these kind of workbench videos, you know, the tool restoration or just building or sharpening or whatever, that are just so beautiful. And now that we've been interacting with cameras and doing that, I really salute and am impressed at just how much effort all of these people are taking to make these just beautiful videos over things that are oftentimes just entertainment and just for fun.
Sure.
And there's a lot of those videos that I would never want to make with the detail they've set up in capturing every single thing and perfectly in focus and edited very crisp, and it's a pretty neat time to be, on YouTube, I'd say.
And to the other side of that, I'm thinking of Double R, the Double R Builder guy.
R&R Builder. Yeah.
R&R Builders.
Is that right? R&R?
R&R, is that the guy that built Jimmy Duresta's shop?
Yeah, yeah.
So that young guy, number one, he's strong, and he's athletic, and he's got great tools, and he has a good grip on construction productivity. And just watching him, it looks like his filming process is not slowing him up much. I mean, he sets a camera out there and just lets it run,
you know, you could be right, but I have a feeling that's, if you asked him that, he would say
it's
slows him down a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he'd say the same thing. But he's got a couple guys, you know, that can run on their own, and so he's got that going for him. And Andrew Camerata, I don't know if that camera slows him up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, he just sets it out there and lets it run.
And rolls.
And so he's not lost track, or at least his approach to making videos is not compromising his productivity much.
Yeah, it's really not. And I love a lot of things about Andrew Camerota's videos, one of which he kind of, it's almost like he sets the camera up and whatever happens over the course of those like 3 days,
yeah, so, it just
like,
happens.
In the middle of it, he's like, oh, I got to replace a tread on my cat. And it's kind of like, well, that's not the video I clicked on. I thought we were going to be digging this out, but I always enjoy it. And he just kind of takes you along. It's really neat. I'd say in pretty much every way that guy is an out of the box thinker.
He is.
And a trailblazer of some sort. And
he is. Love watching him.
Yeah. And the R&R building guy, you know, you're probably right. It's not slowing him down much, just from the amount of like buildings that he's got on YouTube that he's built.
I mean, he's filmed and built.
Yeah, tons of them. And you know, I salute him also because he is. I don't know if he's editing and doing a lot of that work, but he's certainly holding the camera kind of out here and telling the stories as he goes. Yeah. And I guess now that we have an idea what that takes, I pretty much am saluting everybody who's. Man, in this same sort of a lane,
if they're doing it, if they're doing it, if they're producing any work and filming it and uploading it, they're straining.
What do you think about that style of pole barn that he's building? I can't remember what he calls it. Maybe there's an official name, but where it's a pole barn, but the poles are not in the ground. What's up with that?
I like it. It is superior in terms of longevity. It'd be more expensive, but I mean, expense is just a thing, right?
It's not a steel building because it's lumber sides, right? And a steel building is steel girts and everything.
Yes, it's
an
engineered steel building where the columns and the beams and the girts are all manufactured and fabricated, and you bolt together. And it's very straight and it's very strong. And his is kind of a hybrid. You know that apparently that's a very typical approach, maybe Midwest. You know, certainly, apparently back east, where they don't bury into the ground. I don't know, besides the obvious concerns, maybe the reason they don't bury into the ground is they don't have access to the wood, the type of wood that we have. I don't know. But there's a certain amount of expense in drilling those holes, getting that layout right, setting those post bases up out of the grade, and then cutting the posts and drilling them. I mean, there's expense there that we don't have when we just put them in the ground.
You still drill the hole and get the layout. You're still doing a lot of that with the pole.
You're doing a portion of it.
But it certainly takes, you know, on a house, you can grab four or five guys and like lift up a wall.
Mm-hmm.
You got to probably he's got some neat machines, but you're definitely not going to be lifting up one of those walls.
With manpower. No, he's got a nice system.
So that would certainly take a little bit of expense having the equipment to lift it up. Yeah. Overall, if you guys are not watching that channel and his videos, very neat, very cool. I have a feeling, he'll be around for a long time. He seems relatively young in his career and appears to be, you know, mondo successful. And I just really love watching all of his content. Yeah. Really, really neat personality.
So one of the things that we get out of burying these posts in the ground is shear strength out of the post hole.
Right.
You know, I mean, the engineer will design the cross section of the post and the embedment in the soil to get some lateral shear strength out of that wall diaphragm just because it's in the ground. Now, that's worth something, and they have to duplicate that with the bracing that he puts inside. And in a lot of those buildings, he's sheeting the bottom 8 feet with 3/4-inch plywood. Now, that's a very serious shear panel also. So it's just a different method, but it's a gorgeous building.
Yeah, they really are. They really are neat. All right. That's everything I got on my outline. Is there any other things related to this first phase of our spec house here that you think the listeners might want a little more backstory on? Anything you didn't feel like were able to get out during filming?
I haven't said too much about Dave Thomas, the structural engineer we're using on this phase. He has been a real confidence booster and a real pleasure to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I called him yesterday about those variations on those footings. Described to him what we were doing. He pulled up the drawings, looked at his calculations, revisited the assumptions that he was given from this geotechnical guy about the bearing condition of the soil, ran the numbers. Yep, good to go. That is an engineer that's going out of his way to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a real advantage, and I think it'll continue to be an advantage.
These engineers, and I guess a lot of these sort of hybrid white-collar tradesmen sort of, they really have the ability to complicate things by not sticking with you through the duration of the project. Mm-hmm. You know, if an engineer does your job and then fades away, mm-hmm. you're probably going to need that guy at some point in the project. And man, it hurts if they're not, you know,
yeah,
they're able, willing to help out. You know, if somebody's starting one of these, I would say, think about your engineer as more of a long-term relationship. Boy. As opposed to some kind of quick in and out person. Don't yep. need to talk to you again. You're going to need to talk to them again, and you're going to have a lot more, eggs in that basket at that time
yeah.
with that person. I don't know if that's the best way to say it, but that person's going to be with you for a while. So
it's
get
exactly
a good one.
The right way to say it. And if, yeah, price and you know, how good, how fast, how much. It's the same with an engineer, and price on an engineer is one consideration, but it's not the only consideration. And how quickly he can get to your work is one consideration. It's not the only consideration, but the quality of his work, including how responsive he is when you run into a problem, is at least as big a consideration as those other two. So
yeah, that's right. And the same would go for surveyors, any other engineers, electrical, mechanical.
Yeah.
All of these types. If you're working with an architect, then you definitely know this also. It's probably a good sized project. But these guys were not, they are a part of the project for a long time. And so
yeah,
pick a good one.
Yep.
And we got Dave Thomas, not the cheeseburger Wendy's Dave Thomas, although that would also be great, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Different Dave Thomas. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And yeah. if you have specific questions about the project, this is probably where we're going to get to them. Leave those comments on the EC2 channel under some of those videos, and we will do our best to really get into the details about the Spec House series and things that may not have been covered in the videos. It's really a tough thing to boil these videos, not the videos, but the whole footing, for example. You're kind of boiling this whole footing thing down into a dense and interesting part and deciding what's the most relevant bit to include. And we're still kind of experimenting with the best way to do that. So if you have specific questions or you'd like specific things addressed, even in terms of style or the way it's put out there, we would love to hear it from you. Any additional comments, Dad, from you?
Yeah, just following up on that, we are continually balancing how much of what we are doing here is entertainment, how much of what we are doing here is education. And so your input on that is really important to us. And so let us hear. We'll do what we can.
Yeah, and thank you very much for sharing this series. It's getting really great feedback, and the growth that's happening is completely related to you individuals mentioning it with your family and friends or on a job site or whatever. And thank you very much for doing that. It really means probably more than we can even...
Yeah.
say to have this type of support, and it feels like a team behind us all wanting the same thing here. So yeah. With that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. We're going to try to do these once a week, I think, is our goal, but again, this is only number 3, so we'll see what happens. Have a good day.
Thank you.